This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by C2E2, the Chicago Comic Book Convention, coming April 16th through the 18th to McCormick Place in downtown Chicago. Ladies and gentlemen, Ethan Van Sciver.
You burden me with your questions, you happy town lies. You're always asking what it's all about, but don't listen to my replies. You say to me, I don't talk enough. When I do, I'm a fool. These times I've spent, I've realized I'm going to shoot through and leave you the things you say. Your perfect prose just gives you away the things you say. You're unbelievable.
I think that musical interlude should give you some sort of idea of what to expect on this special edition of Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. Good evening. John Suntress here, along with my guest, Ethan Van Sciver, who will be singing and talking about many things today. That's not the only song you're going to hear from Ethan Van Sciver. More selections on the way. Also, conversation about Flash Rebirth. The final issue is coming out later this month at the end of the month. Ethan will give us some of the details and also explain some of the delays that have been happening on the book. We go into detail about his designs on Flash Rebirth and on Green Lantern for the original Rebirth story, and designs that he also incorporated into the Blackest Night story. Interesting, candid thoughts. It's a pleasure to always talk with Ethan. It was a very interesting conversation, and I'm happy to share it with you today on Word Balloon. Today's sponsor, our friends at C2E2, the first comic convention in downtown Chicago for over two decades. It's coming from April 16th through the 18th. You'll want to join us and thousands of comic book fans, creators, and celebrities for a weekend of fun and excitement in the city of broad shoulders. Special guests for this year's show include Alex Ross, Jeff Smith, Jeff Johns, Mike Mignola, Ethan Van Sciver, and hundreds more of your favorite creators. Tickets are only $25 for a one-day pass, $50 for the entire weekend. For a full list of guests, come to their website, c2e2.com. But wait, there's more, because C2E2 and Word Balloon are giving you a chance to win tickets and exclusive C2E2 merchandise before the big weekend. We'll be giving away one amazing VIP package, three weekend passes, five exclusive C2E2 posters signed by creator and guest of honor Alex Ross, and 15 limited edition C2E2 t-shirts. Entering the contest is easy. Visit the website c2e2.com/wordballoon and enter your name and email. That's all it takes. We'll be drawing winners from all the entries on March 19th. Stay tuned for more exciting news about our official C2E2 after-party plans and more ways to win tickets and exclusive merchandise by following C2E2 on Twitter. So again, if you want to enter the contest, visit c2e2.com/wordballoon and enter your name and email. That's all it takes. The conversation with Ethan begins with a discussion of where he feels artists are in this second decade of the 21st century. Now, we had a little connection problem at the beginning, so there's a quick little squibble of sound, but it clears up pretty fast, and you'll hear the rest of our conversation. Ethan Van Sciver on this special edition of Word Balloon.
It's hard to, to be a working artist right now in comic books if you have that mindset, John.
Really? You think so?
I do think so, because I think the balance of power between writer and artist has shifted so far in one direction. Artists are almost employees of the writer. It's a question of the writer is the leader, and then who are his guys? Who are the guys that are going to tell his story? And it's an uncomfortable position for me. I'm an alpha dog.
I understand that.
Don't want to be put next to the type of artist who is just going to get a script and draw it, as it is, and I put an awful lot of thought into what I do, an awful lot of thought.
Of course.
Really, from the amount of creating and design and thinking scenes through that I do when I'm really, really working and contributing, I mean, it's... I may as well go off on my own. That's kind of the situation right now. That's where my head is. I'm talking to other artists who feel the same way. It used to be the pendulum was way, way, way back in the other direction. I mean, in the 1990s, where, you know, artists would get these, perhaps, I mean, you know, masterful scripts from writers like Peter David or Mark Waid, and then just turn in these big balloon head splash pages, completely ignoring, you know, careful panel-to-panel work, you know, no self-control, no discipline. You know, the story never came first. It was always the image and then reselling, you know, the original art. Like, that was at the forefront of a lot of artists' minds.
How Certainly.
How much money can I make from this original if I draw it this way rather than this way, which would be more appropriate and do more for the story? And I think that maybe the fact that that was so out of control back in the 90s has led to the situation now where artists have virtually no control, no power in a creative situation. I got, you know, and yet I do, and yet I contribute so much, and yet, you know, so much of, you know, what is in my books came from me. So to my way of thinking, I am a writer who hasn't done it yet. You know what I mean?
I do. Well, I think in the best circumstance, obviously, it needs to be, I think, an even partnership. I have a feeling you're not the only person that feels that way, too, that, you know, well, I've heard this from other artists. I've seen artists complaining on Twitter about that, actually.
Well, you know, the writers are that good now. I mean, you know.
Sure.
If we look around at the pantheon of top-selling artists that are available to us at Marvel in D.C., and you see how I just switched that relationship from employee to employer. As an artist, I have choices of working with, you know, terrific writers that, you know, on a level that I don't think comics has seen in such a long time.
Mm-hmm.
A creative level. You know, Bendis, Miller, Jeff Johns, Grant Morrison, Gail Simone, Ed Brubaker. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I mean, so. You know, I understand, but at the same time, I think the artist community is more powerful than it's ever been with McNiven and Finch and Coy Pell and Ivan Reyes. You know, these guys who I've spoken to in depth, except for Coy Pell, who I hope to get to know soon, you know, really have some compelling and exciting ideas of their own, but feel they feel hindered, you know, to actually take the chance, because the system is what it is now. I think we're in a way discouraged to go off on our own.
Are the publishers not hearing artists, you know, come to pitch, you know, to pitch an idea? I mean, it's the...
Well, you can look around now and you can see artists who said, I don't care, I'm doing it anyway. I mean, you know, Tony, oh dear God, I'm forgetting his name, Tony Daniel.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
Scott Collins, who just said, you know, I really feel like drawing a Solomon Grundy miniseries, and I feel like writing it too, so that's what I'm going to do. And DC responds in kind. I mean, you know, Dan DiDio has said to me, you know, DC Comics is friendly, friendlier now to a situation where an artist could, you know, do it all by himself than maybe we were in the past. So that's good.
Okay.
The problem is that, A, it's scary to do that, and B, there's always a carrot being dangled in front of you that discourages you from doing it. You know, there's always something like, you know, here's a huge project that, you know, is going to sell real well and keep you in the public eye, and you know. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to win you a lot of fans. So maybe you want to do this instead of Cyber Frog or something that, you know, is close to your heart.
Sure.
You know, something that you have. So, you know, it's difficult to break away. It's difficult to break away. It's not, you know, there's no evil inherent in any of this. It's all good. It just might not be healthy long term. So, you know, For an artist like me now, you know, and a few of my friends. I mean, you look at Steve McNiven, who is
doing an Icon project at Marvel with Mark Millar, creator-owned, you know. Time seems right, doesn't it?
For a change and to go to that artist's only... Well, I think, you know, everything seems to work in decades, and I would say the 90s were an artist-heavy period that where I do think story suffered, and not from... I don't know. I mean, now you were an active guy in that time. How would you characterize, as you see, you explained in the Peter David example that you gave, but, you know, I got to be honest, it was during that period where I felt art was too prevalent and we weren't getting a denser story experience and denser characterization. And it's not that I don't think individual artists aren't capable of that kind of storytelling, but I just know from the 90s that was a bad period. I look at the last 10 years as a good period, and I'll admit, you know, I come from a writing background. I was a journalist and am a journalist and in my day job, and sometimes I kind of missed what I felt was a little bit more emphasis on character and nuanced story and just better storytelling. So I don't know what went wrong in the 90s that would keep it from happening again in the, you know, the current era?
Too much money. I mean...
Okay.
Yeah, you know, I think the difference between now and then is that... Well, look, if I'm being paid $1 million an issue, and I have a nagging feeling that, two things happen at that point. Okay, one, I'm thinking, but I better, you know... make all of this money that I can while I can make it.
Sure.
And second, I'm thinking, I must be pretty spectacular to be making this kind of money for the work that I'm doing. In fact, I might be doing too much work. Like, you know, I might be putting too much effort into my work. I can probably get away with this. And I think that happened to some of the artists in the 90s.
Okay.
There was no quality control. I mean, because there didn't need to be. Everybody was making so much money doing what they were doing that what could be wrong?
I understand.
If suddenly books stop selling, 500,000 copies, somebody might be, put in a position to say,
yeah, hey, wait a minute.
I mean, what are we doing wrong? But, you know, if I'm selling, you know, 500,000 copies of Flash, then I'm doing a good job no matter what I'm doing.
Right.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I think the difference now is that kind of temptation, that kind of incentive isn't there. The only incentive for me to do, a creator-owned title is love, is the desire to tell a story of my own. And why would I cheat myself out of that? Because, you know, there's no tempting reason to do it badly. I would do the best I could, so that maybe I would gain fans and it would become something. So I think that's the difference between now and then. I mean, when I say that the 90s were artist-centric, they certainly were in a bad way.
Yes.
But I do think that, you know, now maybe, they're writer-centric in a bad way in the sense that writers can get away with anything. I mean, you can do a whole issue of, book Superhero X where it's nothing but talking heads. I mean, you can inflict that on an artist and their audience. If you're a good enough writer, if you have a big enough reputation, I mean, you know, that kind of power is in the hands of some writers. You're no longer sitting there saying, you know, I really don't feel like writing an action scene into this issue of, the Hulk or Batman. But I know I'm supposed to because that's what my job is. That's what the audience expects when they buy a Batman comic book. That kind of power is dangerous. I think it needs to go back and forth, or there needs to be a middle ground where the artist is saying, or the writer is saying, I hope I'm not boring the artist to death. And the artist likewise is saying, I hope I'm doing justice to the writer's story. So I do think this new decade is going to see a shift in that. I think you're going to see a lot more big name artists choosing to do it for themselves.
Well, we've got a couple examples, and you mentioned them, and I'll take a further one, and that's Day Trippers with Gabriel Pa and Fabio Moon. doing their own thing. It also seems like this is much more of an American problem than a European problem. Because every time I will talk to an American writer about some exotic artist that I've never seen before, Filthy Rich, for example, and I don't have the book in front of me, but Brian Azzarello's book, I was talking to him, and I'm like, where did he, you know, who did he work with before? And he's like, nobody. He wrote his own stuff. Jordy Bernay works, his, you know, does his own stuff when he's not working with, you know, Justin Gray and Jimmy Palmiani on, like, Jonah Hex or something American.
Right.
And so it's odd that they, you know, they're given that license in Europe. But I got to be honest, too. I mean, I'm not reading Batman right now. And Tony Daniel has beautiful art, but I got to be honest, Battle for the Cowl, I felt, bit me in the ass. I thought it was a beautiful book, but it was a poorly executed story, in my view. And again, I have a lot of respect for Tony as an artist, but I felt that story was a very flat story. And again, no entire movement should be judged on a single book, and I'm not suggesting that. Because again, look at Day Trippers. I think that is a very complete story, and I think it's great. And I don't know, man. I mean, I see what you're saying, and I think you're right. The pendulum swings, it seems, every decade, and it probably is time for artists to kind of step up if they're losing their power, as you say, to, you know, reassert themselves and do these other things. Is there a fear? I was talking about an artist who has been doing book adaptations lately, and I'm not going to name names, and he was characterized as doing these book adaptations as it being a really risky venture, and I was shocked to hear that, because I'm like, why is it risky? He's still putting product out, and if anything, he's putting product out that's going to sell much better in the bookstores, and it's not like he's disappearing from the audience for decades. I said, you know, and also the guy has time to do cover work as well, so I'm really confused. And I said, how is this a big gamble? Now you tell me, is there that kind of fear that if you were to do your own thing, as opposed to taking that big ticket, you know, safe, big exposure job with a high-profile writer, that 6 months of doing that, of doing your own thing, or, you know, is too much of a risk?
Yeah, I feel that way. I'm terrified of it. I'm really scared because I don't know. I mean, I've got a lot of fans that followed me from Green Lantern to Flash.
Sure.
And Geoff Johns as well. I feel like I've got a pocket full of fans that'll follow me to somewhere else if I decide to do something else. They'll at least take a chance on it. They'll pick it up and flip through it. I'd have to completely knock their eyes out of their heads with it, though. But yes, there's this fear that it's like going from movies to stage, in a way, where you're just worried that you're not going to get the kind of exposure that you might have had if you chose to do Batman.
And again, for 6 months, is it more just the financial? Because I just think 6 months is such a blip.
It is lately.
You know what I mean? Yeah, because it's one story. It's one story arc, for example. Yeah. Now, and I can appreciate from the financial standpoint of turning down the royalties of doing a Batman arc versus doing Cyber Frog for 6 months.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. I don't think the public's going to forget you. And the oblique, you know, referenced artist that I'm talking about, that's the other thing, too. I'm like, well, it's not like he's disappeared. There's plenty of his cover work on the racks, and I don't get it. I don't understand what the problem is.
Well, let me name a couple of names.
Okay.
Dale Keown.
Okay.
Okay, one of the greatest comic book artists to come from the 90s, super, super powerful talent, somebody who I consider to be a shark. In other words, if Dale Keown were swimming in the same waters as I was, he would be taking all the jobs that I wanted, because he's so much better than me. He's so good. So I'm not worried about Dale Keown at all because I don't know where to find him.
I don't either, actually. I don't even know what he's doing these days.
He's over at Top Cow. No offense to Top Cow, but he's at Top Cow doing Darkness, Pit, you know, kind
okay.
of crossovers.
Okay.
And I'm sure he's having fun. And at the end of the day, that's what's important. But I look at him and I perceive that he's just not in the same industry that I'm in anymore. He's not working right now. Even though he is working and producing beautiful work.
Of course, yes.
It's not on the books that I normally see. It's not in my comp box. I don't see it, you know, coming from Marvel Comics. I don't see it as competition. Okay, so, you know, that worries me. And then also, another example of the reverse of that, Gary Frank, who was gone for so long on a book called Midnighters or Midnight Sun.
Was it Midnight Nation? Was it the Straczynski thing? Or
I think it may have been. And it was probably a creatively rewarding thing, and I hope they sold the movie option. Also, Gary Frank, I would see that work, and I would be like, oh, my God, it's so good. Gary Frank is so good, but he wasn't working in the same, you know, body of water that I was. He wasn't at Marvel or DC, and so people weren't really considering him the same way, I feel like. And then suddenly Gary Frank comes over and does Superman.
Right.
And, you know, explodes in popularity. He chooses to do a Superman project with Geoff Johns. Great idea, great decision. He does it just right.
And gorgeous, now, yes.
I feel like Gary Frank is the single best artist working at DC Comics, in my opinion. I told Jeff that.
His Superman stuff has been great. Secret Origins has been fantastic, and the long run that he had with Jeff on the Legion arc and things that led up to, you know, them doing Secret Origin. No, I think it's great work. I liked his he was with Straczynski, too, at Marvel doing Supreme Power, I want to say, as well.
Yeah, it was something, but it wasn't like... It wasn't where you would want him. Like,
well, it wasn't Cap. It wasn't Spider-Man. It wasn't a main Marvel character.
You look at a weapon like Gary Frank, and you go, where can I best utilize Gary Frank? You know, you put him on, over at Marvel, yeah, you do. You put him on Spider-Man. You put him on Hulk, which he was on for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And you put him on, you know, Avengers or something. And then at DC, you put him on Superman and Batman.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah, well, look at Eaglesham. The years Dale Eaglesham was at CrossGen. And, I mean, you know, it's weird, man, because I guess being in Chicago, you know, we get everything. And I don't know. I mean, you're in Jersey, so we're, you know.
I'm in North Carolina.
Oh, excuse me. Okay, now you're in North Carolina. Are the stores in North Carolina not carrying, you know, the second-tier publishers?
No, I'm sure they do. I just don't see them. I don't seek them out.
Okay.
I just, for some reason, my eye goes over them. I look at Marvel and DC, and I look at the sales charts, and I look at what's popular, what's happening, because, you know, I really hate to say it, but I don't have time to read 300 comic books a month. I read a few just to know what's going on, man.
Right. Well, yeah, you buy what you like, and you want to, you know, I understand that. Okay.
Right. So, you know, it's like Siege just came out. And so I read Siege, but that was the only Marvel book that I've read in God knows how long. You know, I'm trying to keep a sort of flavor of what my friends are doing at DC. I read a few Gail Simone Wonder Womans. So I thought they were really good.
Yeah, Apresti's been good.
Some Blackest Night, some Green Lantern. I haven't read the whole thing yet.
Okay. okay.
Just to have an idea. Well,
I just think it's interesting because you designed all the...
There's so much of it.
all the rings and everything and all the insignias. So that, there is so much of it. I can appreciate that, too. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's neat. Like, I'll flip through it and look at, you know. But I don't really sit down and do a lot of reading now because I want to focus on, you know, my plans and stuff. But, so maybe you're right, though. Maybe that's a failing of my perception that, you know, just because I don't see, you know, these artists doing what they want to do. It doesn't mean everybody doesn't.
Well, I invite a healthy talk back on this episode from fans because, like I say, I don't know. I mean, I think I'm kind of a meat and potatoes mainstream guy myself. I read other publishers, and I think I read a good amount of other publishers as well. And even the books that I don't read on a consistent basis, I can't help but browse and, you know, look at the covers and look in the interiors. And I think I keep a pretty good, you know, check on what's going on in the other companies, at least in general and everything. So from a look standpoint, I don't know. There's segment one of our conversation with Ethan Van Sciver here on Word Balloon. This was a rare opportunity for us to delve into various topics and do a bunch of different things. Ethan was interested in presenting some of his music along with his thoughts. While we're taking the break, this gives me the opportunity to remind you to come to wordballoon.com and check out our archive of many interviews with comic book creators and people from film, television, and animation as well. Recent examples, we talked to Neil Holman, the art director from Archer, the very funny series that's on FX. We talked with the Brave and Bold producers recently as well. And we've got other ones, too, going back to our conversations with people like Thomas Jane. We spoke to Edward James Olmos and our many conversations with television writers like Jeff Loeb and Jesse Alexander. So come to wordballoon.com, check out the archive, and see for yourself. It's all waiting for you at wordballoon.com. And now let's go back to the song stylings of Ethan Van Sciver. Talk about, I mean, obviously, I think a lot of people are going to have some questions about Flash Rebirth and where you are and where the book is in general. The final issue is coming out in, is it coming out in February or is it coming out this month?
February 24th. It's finished and it's, I guess it's being colored and finalized. But, yeah, it's on its way. Hooray.
Cool. Yeah, I know. I understand. And when projects like this have big delays,
yes,
people have a lot of questions, so... What can you tell us about the delays that kept the book from coming out, you know, on time?
Well, see, the thing about it is that, you know, now that it's done, I'll talk about it. I didn't want to talk about it then because it's personal, you know, and I don't.
I do understand.
Those guys who ask for sympathy. I don't want people to know too much about what's going on in my private life. It's just, it's not, you know, if the book isn't coming out, it's my fault. Period. It really doesn't matter, and it shouldn't matter to fans. Last April, I started having chest pains, and I think that the past few years of my life, I was living a very unhealthy lifestyle. I'm not, you know, I would sit and I would draw all the time intensely, and I would, in order to feel a buzz. Okay, in order to sit there and, you know, constantly be buzzing, I would drink soda, I would have chocolate donuts, I was constantly stuffing my face with garbage just so that I felt energized, that short, sugary, you know, kind of thing.
Sure.
That buzz to keep moving. And, you know, I gained an awful lot of weight. I gained about 60 pounds in 5 years. And people were telling me, but the weird thing about getting fat is that you don't know it's happening to you when it's happening to you.
I understand.
Those of you who are listening to this who are in shape, you'll never understand.
I think you're talking to a comic book crowd, so I think there actually are a lot of people in the
audience. I talk to a lot of comic book fans who are really like health nuts, and it's kind of neat.
Okay.
you know, they're giving me advice and stuff, but. You know, if you look in the mirror, you don't look any different to yourself.
I understand.
You look down and you go, huh, why don't my clothes fit as well as they used to? I must be getting fat, but I don't look bad. It's weird. And then you see photographs of yourself, and you're like, holy cow, is that me? I don't recognize myself at all. So it's a really strange thing. It's like a trick that lets you get fatter and fatter. Well, anyway, so here I am, 35 years old, and I'm having chest pains. And they don't go away. So, you know, I'm scared because I know of another comic book artist who is my age and about my build who suffered a heart attack the year before. And so I talked to my wife about it, and I, you know, I admitted that it's not something I would admit unless I really thought it was serious. And we went to the hospital, and the doctor said, yeah, you know, you're in trouble, and told me some stuff. I learned some stuff about my health situation, my medical situation, and I learned that if I didn't do something about it, I was going to have a heart attack. So I, it's just so embarrassing. I wish there was tinkly music behind me.
No, I understand. I always feel like Oprah when we get into situations like this, and that's yeah. Not my intent, man.
Sorry,
but you know,
everybody, I'm trying to. All right. So anyway, I joined a gym. My wife did. I. This is something I always think about. I always think, you know, I'm going to join a gym someday. You know, when I finish this project, I'm going to take all this weight off. And I never do it because the next project comes. And it's
sure.
Just, you know, this is not. For me, this drawing comics is not a healthy lifestyle. So, anyway, she got me these two personal trainers working this gym nearby my house, and it's this really, really cool health club where it's almost like a doctor's office. It's not like a big gym, public gym. It's a private gym, and you know these two trainers work with you one on one. And they take you into these sort of cubicles that are partitioned off so that you're not around other people. It's the perfect thing for somebody who's really embarrassed to be at the gym.
Okay.
In the situation that he's in. So that was in May, and I've been with it ever since, and I've dropped 40 pounds.
Terrific.
What that's done to me, though, is it's completely thrown off the way that I work. You know, I started this book in late November of 2008. I started this series. We had planned it for a long time. Some other personal things that had nothing to do with me delayed us from getting to it until November. But I started it in November. I know I'm the type of guy who does a book every 2 months. I've always said that to everybody. I always hope to do better than that. Sometimes I will let myself do better than a book a month. A book every 2 months, and I'll do a book in a month, and then I hate that book. So I realized that in order to be happy with the work that I do, I need to be spending 8 weeks on every issue. Getting healthy messed up my schedule, messed up my deadlines. It meant that I was active. It meant that I was out of the house. It meant that I had a place to be other than my desk every morning. Between May and now, I'm still at the same gym. I'm still working. I'm learning now, you know, as my heart is working a lot better and my clothes are fitting better and my face is slimmed down and everything, I'm learning now how to manage this kind of a lifestyle, this kind of a schedule, the things that I eat now and I can't have anymore, and still eat the right kinds of foods, you know, proteins and everything that'll give me that buzz naturally. You know, that'll make it easy for me to concentrate on my artwork. But that took some time. So I hereby apologize. I do apologize that Flash Rebirth was late. I expected it would be late towards the end. I knew that just because of when I started it and how long it takes me to do a book, we would probably miss 6 weeks in between the issues. But it looks like we've, you know, missed considerably more than that. And so for the fans who were so very, very patient, for my editor and who, you know, waited it out with me and stuff, I, you know, oh, just thank you very, very much. And again, I do apologize. But I don't feel like I really had much of a choice. And if you want to come up at a convention when you see me and yell at me about it, that's cool. But I hope you'll also say, oh, it looks like you lost some weight.
Well, I look forward to seeing you in April, man, and I, you know, honestly. Well, and I, not to yell at you, but to see the difference. But also, do you feel comfortable? Have you rediscovered how you can fit your art into this new schedule that you're kind of dealing with, and the choices, the lifestyle choices you've made?
It's still a lot slower, you know, because I do. I have to get up at a certain time. I have to be at the gym. I have to constantly monitor what I do all through the day to make sure that I'm eating every 3 hours. I mean, you know, the one thing that you learn when you're getting healthy is it's not that you're eating too much too often. It's you're not eating the right things, and you need to eat the right things a lot. So, you know, every 3 hours I have a meal plan. You know, I'm supposed to be eating an apple at noon. You know, I'm supposed to have, you know, a light turkey sandwich at 3 o'clock. And I just have to be with it all the time. Before, you know, I would be, my schedule and my lifestyle was completely different. I would gorge myself on junk. I would, you know, drink Mountain Dew and all this awful stuff.
Sure.
And I would work for 24 hours straight, or I would work for 20 hours straight, and then I'd crash for like 5 hours and then get back up and get back to the desk. And eventually I would find myself working overnight. And I can't do things like that anymore. It was great for getting work done. It was fantastic for getting tiny little details done and just, you know, all of that. But, you know, I'm afraid it was killing me.
I understand.
And,
no.
You know, I saw George Perez at MegaCon last year. And this was right before I started to have problems. And George Perez, who used to be jolly, shall we say?
Yes.
Lost all of that weight.
Yes, he did.
All of it. He looks dynamite.
Yes.
He looked great in MegaCon. He looks even better now. It took him a year to get from where he was to where he was at MegaCon last year. And I talked to him about it and was really inspired. And he said it is a lifestyle change, and it involves, you know, being active and watching what you eat and everything. And, you know, I said, boy, I'd really like to do that too. You know, again, I think George was having problems getting a book out too during that time.
Yes.
And maybe he has the same reasons that I do. But, you know, it wasn't so hard to do. Once you start seeing results. And, I mean, I look at, you know, my legs now, and they're a completely different shape than they used to be. You know, I see hard edges on my body and things that weren't there before. Anyone who's overweight and who knows what I'm talking about, you know.
I do.
Get out there and do it. It's fun.
No, I hear you, man. And that's what I was saying before about comic book people. Probably a lot more people than I think you realize probably do know where you're coming from, because I always say the beauty about a comic book convention is at that place I'm a medium, so no matter what the tag on the back of my shirt says. So no, I know exactly what you mean, man. And
let me tell you something. I was wearing a triple XL Green Lantern shirt this time last year. And right now, I'm wearing a large.
That's terrific, man.
So, I mean, you know, I haven't been a large since I was 23 or so. So
terrific.
Yeah, it's you start to see that happen. And I still, you know, I notice some changes, but I still look in the mirror and go, boy, I got a long way to go. I've got a long way to go before I look like the kid from True Blood. Which, you know what I mean? Like, you see guys like that on TV, and you go, boy, I wonder if I could get there. I wonder if I'm capable of looking like that, and how long would it take, and what would I have to do? But it's possible, because I've already lost all of this weight, and I know that in a couple of years, if I keep at this, I could probably get there. So yeah, it's exciting.
That's great, man. Well, that's cool, and I'm glad that, you know, the current deadlines are past you, and you know, you don't have to. You know, no, honestly, man, it's tough when your job, and especially when you're working your own hours, is to sit somewhere and get something done by not moving too much and not really being as active as you could be. It's very easy to fall into bad habits. Believe me, I know, sitting in a cube, talking in a microphone versus, you know, delivering things or working on a loading dock or, you know, roofing or, you know, being a roofer or a million other more physical jobs.
I envy guys like that. I mean, I don't, because I realize how lucky I am.
Sure.
When you think about the billions of people in the world and the fact that a handful of them actually get to draw superheroes for a living. I realize how lucky I am, so don't get me wrong. But then I look at guys who have these active jobs, who get to work with their hands outdoors and stuff. And boy.
Well, I'm glad you're finding that balance, and yeah, you know, it sounds like you're doing, you know, as I told you, I lost a little bit of weight, but it was a deck chair off the Titanic, and I got a long way to go. And
you get there, John. You just have to commit to it, and you have
right.
to have people help you. I mean, I couldn't have done it on my own at all. I wouldn't have done it without my wife, and I couldn't have done it without my two trainers at Fitness Together, who've just become good friends, and they're great guys.
Very cool.
And have just taught me how to take responsibility for myself. you know, in that way.
Take I hear
responsibility
you.
For my health, which is something that you, like you said, it's very easy to just let it slip. And I'm a skinny guy. I mean, the thing is, naturally, anybody who knew me, you know, in high school, I was a twig. So this is all the result of drawing comics. And I knew that when I was 19, by the way, I thought to myself, boy, how come everybody who draws comics for a long time ends up looking like Raymond Burr? And I didn't want to be Raymond Burr. You know, I didn't want to. I ended up sort of almost getting there.
Okay, that was a heavy segment of the show. So let's lighten things up with another musical interlude from Ethan Van Sciver, and then we'll get on with an examination of the work in Flash Rebirth, Green Lantern Rebirth, his designs for Blackest Night, and more good conversation with Ethan Van Sciver. But first, this original song from Ethan.
This song's for the dreamer in all of us. My bomb shelter is pretty nice. I took Dwight Eisenhower's advice. It's full of things I like. A stationary bike, powdered milk, Slim Jims, and rice. It's not as if I asked my spouse to excavate beneath our house. She told me it was silly. She said, now come on, really. There's only so much she allows. And it's a shame, cause when the bombs are exploding, you'll all be freeloading, but I'm prepared, you see. With a mushroom problem, and there's just enough room in my bomb shelter for me and maybe my cat. What do you think of that? My bomb shelter has bonsai trees, a generator with DVDs, but it's only one man sized, so while you're vaporized, I'll enjoy its amenities, cause, you know, my bomb shelter is mine, all mine. Don't wanna hear you whine. It won't seem so dumb when the zombies come and I'm watching what's my line. Let's see if you're cocky when it's Nagasaki outside in your little town. You'll absorb radiation while I'm on vacation 25 feet underground. I'll be drinking milk in pajamas made of silk. My bomb shelter is pretty nice. You should take Eisenhower's advice.
Did you read Flash Rebirth? Have you read?
Of course I have. I've been reading every issue. I'm a huge Flash fan. Well, I got some basic questions now.
Okay.
One is, and maybe this is a big tease on your guys' part, but you know, when you made an announcement actually on this Word Balloon show that Wally's outfit was going to change.
Mm.
Oh, my God. You cracked the internet in half. I know a lot of people were very upset about that. They're very possessive of Wally, and we've talked about that before, and his role to a certain generation, much as Barry has a role to a certain generation. And luckily now the reveals have been out. We've seen the new looks for a lot of the characters. Let's start with Wally's costume, though. Was that the design you always had in mind?
No, and you'll see a couple of other designs in the Flash Rebirth hardcover. I just gave over all of my sketches today to the guys who were putting that together. No, not at all. In fact, it was a really tough thing to do because I had the idea initially. When I spoke to Jeff, I said, look, you know, Barry's back. He's the king of flashes. It's not. I accidentally said that once at a convention, and the fans were going to kill me for it. but you want to subliminally say, you want to subtly say that this is the Flash. Okay, now Wally's the Flash too, but Barry is Grandmaster Flash. I hope that's
You just did. That's good.
Okay. And Wally is, if Barry is King Arthur, Wally is Lancelot.
Okay.
Okay? So I thought the first thing that I want to do is I want to cover his nose the way and use the same cowl that was used in the Flash TV show. Because to me, it subtly suggests, the way it comes down over the nose a little bit, like a knight's helmet.
Kind of okay.
Thing. And I thought, we've got to take the Flash symbol and take it off the middle of his chest. And I don't remember why I thought this was a good idea. But I thought, you know, what we'll do is we'll take that symbol off the side of his chest and put it on his shoulders, on each shoulder, he'll wear it. And Barry is the one who wears it on the center of his chest. And I think there were a couple of other things. Like, I was going to alter his belt to make the lightning bolt look a little bit more like a W or something like that. But you know what? The first time I did it, and again, you fans will get to see the sketches and they can boo and hiss. because we all did. I mean, first time I did it, I went, this doesn't look a whole lot different than Flash, and it's not really, these aren't substantial changes. So let me take another crack at it, and this time I'm going to go hog wild. I'm not going to worry about making him look like a Flash at all. I'm going to give Wally West a new costume. And so the second take of Wally West was completely different. He wore this lightning-shaped vest that wrapped around his torso and had bigger, clunkier boots and a little bit more, dare I say, a little bit more Guy Gardner of the Flashes.
Okay.
Than that. And that was resoundingly rejected. I got a call from Joey Cavalieri like, are you crazy? I mean, we got to have a talk. And I said, I'm just trying stuff, you know, I'm just trying. So it was a great costume. It's just...
It's not the Flash.
Fans of Wally West would be furious. And so the more we tried, the more paralyzed we felt by the fact that, unlike Green Lantern, Flash, you know, it's so easy to design speedster costumes. It's impossible to design a Flash costume, especially one that doesn't upset the already very worried and nervous Wally West fans.
Certainly.
So I threw up my hands, and I said, I don't know what to do, guys. You know, why don't we go to Dark Flash and start from there? And, they agreed because they thought that was safe. And Jeff said, let's use the symbol from the animated series Flash, the JLU Flash, whatever that was.
Yeah.
And it was just a single, you know, it was a lightning bolt, but it was only bent once.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, fine. And he said, and the eyes have to be white. And I said, yeah, I agree. And then I think the assistant editor, Chris Conroy, said, I think that the chest thing should be made of metal, kind of like Ivan's doing on Green Lantern, because he's Keystone Tough, you know, like a tribute to hood ornaments or something like that. And I said, fine. And like I said, by that point, I hate to say it, I was resigned to it. I just said, I'll do whatever you guys want. I honestly, I don't know anymore. I don't know what's right to do. So we did. We came out with this design that pleased and I think disappointed people at the same time, because they were pleased that it was still clearly a Flash design. But I think, like me, they were disappointed that it wasn't substantially different and yet still a Flash design. I couldn't find it, guys. I tried my best. I just wanted to, at the end of the day, what our goal was to separate him from Barry Allen and make him unique, so that when the two of them stood together or in long shots of the two of them, small figures, you'd be able to tell the difference. And we accomplished that. But did we set the world on fire with an exciting new Flash design? Not really. We put together a composite that was comfortable. So, one of the little disappointments of this book for me, I have to say.
Well, not knowing what intangible idea you had that you couldn't really kind of bring forward.
The thing was, I got scared. I mean, on Green Lantern, nobody ever said no to me before. When I was designing, you know, the lantern costumes, the symbols, all the new characters, nobody said no. They said go and do. And when somebody tells you go and do, and then, you know, you have carte blanche, that's a wonderful thing for a creative person. You know, you are fearless. You take chances. You do things. But right away, on this situation, we were given a list of, you know, do's and don'ts almost. And then I turned in two designs that were rejected. And suddenly I was like, this is out of my hands. This character does not belong to me, which is a realization that, you know, is upsetting. Because even though I'm fully aware that I don't own any of these characters, in a way, when you're stewarding them, when you are their shepherd and protecting them and you know, moving them along here, you need to feel a little bit of ownership over them, or else you will not do anything worth reading.
I understand. Absolutely.
Worth looking at. You need to feel free. So,
well, in the case of the Green Lanterns, there, it wasn't like you were designing a new look for Hal or a new look for Kyle or Guy. You know, you were creating other aliens, other Sinestro Corps bad guys, and the symbols for the other lanterns. So there was still that black and whatever color, you know, the lantern was going to be. There was that basic shape, Green Lantern costume shape, and the changes were subtle, at least in my view. And then again,
look, I mean, on Green Lantern, I said, you know what, the little symbol on his chest comes out, and it flashes all over the place like a police siren.
Absolutely, which was cool.
I said, you know what, the blacks of his costume are solid black, because they would be. You know, you can't see, they're not like spandex, they don't reflect back light. So when you delineate muscle on a Green Lantern costume, it makes it look like what it isn't, and what it is black energy. So it's all black, and nobody said anything. And, you know, this is the way Kilowog looks now. Nobody said anything. Guy Gardner has a haircut. It's a buzz cut. That bowl cut's stupid. Everybody's like, okay. So, I mean, you know, it's like as I went.
I see.
You know, I was
okay.
Making these, I mean, tweaks, right? But still, by the time we got to Sinestro, all right, Sinestro and Sinestro Corps was a complete overhaul of
Very
that
true.
Character.
Absolutely.
That was 100% mine. And zero conflict from editorial.
Well,
I could say, you know, this is what Sinestro's demeanor is, and this is why he's different from the way we've seen him portrayed before. In fact, he's yellow, not blue, and, you know, he wears the symbol on his chest that we established in Green Lantern Rebirth, and of course, you know, a haircut, because I hate that haircut he's got, and he doesn't smile anymore. All of these things were just sort of happening, like these decisions were being made, these solid decisions that really, like, helped shape this classic character into a modern character that could support his own series, perhaps. And I felt free to do that. And you know, the Flash, there were just, for some reason, there were a lot more no's, and I don't know if it was because my ideas were bad, and maybe it was, that's fair. Or because, I don't know.
Well, I'll throw in another possibility, too. In the cases of all those Green Lantern characters, they've been off the table for a long enough time. Because even Guy Gardner had been the Warrior and then was just Guy for the longest time. In the case of Kilowog, I forget how long he was dead. I forget how long, Sinestro certainly had been dead for a long time. And that, you know, and also even Hal being away as long as he was, too, that the changes you made were subtle changes that, if anything, you know, gave more definition to the look rather than being a radical change from what had been there before.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, and the other thing is, by the way, it's always easier to make changes to villains than it is to heroes for some reason.
I can see that.
Like we got Professor Zoom. Jeff said, I want Eobard Thawne back. I said, yeah, me too. And then you immediately started thinking. I said, I got really excited about Professor Zoom. You know, I said, first of all, what we want to do with Professor Zoom is we want to emphasize the professor part. You know, everything that he does, he represents what people who hate academicians, he is all of that. He's the established, collegiate professor type. Who was that guy from Colorado who upset conservatives?
Ward Churchill.
Ward Churchill. That's who he is. That's our Professor Zoom. Don't you see? And Jeff said, I don't know. I said, no. I was really arguing with, and I remember telling Joey Cavalieri too. I was telling people. And I said, if we can get that into this character, suddenly he'll be unique. Suddenly he won't just be the lunatic that chases Barry around. There's a reason for it, and he's got a distinctive personality. And I'm going to give him this pointer. Jeff, in issue one of Flash Rebirth, you see Professor Zoom absorbing the lightning. And Jeff had written in there that he had ripped the lightning rod off the top of the police station, and that's what he was using. And I got very passionate about it. I said, that's silly. I'm going to give him a pointer, like what a professor uses when he's pointing at the chalkboard. He schools people with it. He can smack Barry in the face with it. He instructs him, And furthermore, he's had this thing for a long time, and it's coated with a substance called molybdenum, which is kind of a coppery substance that when reacted, when combined with great heat, molybdenum's chemical formula, when it's hit by something like lightning, the chemical formula is MO, molybdenum, oxygen 3, MOO3, plus Z, the lightning, Zoom, backwards. And I was like, that's where he got his name from. And that's what the Z is in the formula.
Outstanding.
The formula that Jesse Quick uses, that Z equals the magic, the special lightning that's going to happen once every... So excited about this, John. You have to understand what it is.
I hear you.
Somebody who's making decisions like this to affect, a long-term property. I mean, this is how it all unravels. You sit and you obsess about disparate elements of comic books that happened 70 years ago and 10 years ago, and then you try to find the through line and you try to connect them. And I was actively, discussing these things with Jeff Johns and just like, this is what this means and this is what this means. So, but at the same time, I don't feel like, all of these things came together in the finished book. I think I hope to see some of these things get used, some of these ideas and everything get thrown in the future, because I just think it's good for the Flash to take into consideration his long history, the long history of DC Speedsters, and make it all into one. The same way we did with Green Lantern. Make the whole thing cohesive.
I agree. I definitely agree. And I think that it was interesting to... I kind of felt that vibe from the book, obviously, that you're trying to get this through line to all the speedsters. And are we, Libby, or, I'm thinking of her mom now. Is Jesse going to be Jesse Quick?
As far as I know, yeah.
Okay, or is she, will she still be Liberty Bell, or will she be Jesse Quick?
Oh, as far as I know, she's Jesse Quick, but things change.
I understand.
I'm not really sure.
Well, once your stewardship ends with a character, I understand that it is, she's an active member of the JSA as well.
Totally. Well, we love Jesse Quick. I've always loved Jesse Quick. She used to be an Impulse all the time.
Sure.
And Jeff loved her, too, and he had just left JSA. And so I said, let's be greedy and take her with us. Because we're over to Flash now. We could make her Jesse Quick and have her in our book. And he liked that idea. So is that a permanent thing? That's up to them, If it were up to me, yeah, she would be Jesse Quick. She'd carry on her father's proud legacy.
Sure. Well, maybe she'll be like Hank Pym, and depending on what her mood's in, sometimes she'll be Giant Man, sometimes she'll be Yellow Jacket. So sometimes sometimes she'll still be Liberty Bell, and sometimes she'll be Jesse Quick.
Yeah.
I loved Irie taking the Impulse costume, and that was something I don't think anybody saw coming.
If you guys hated that, then blame me, because that was me saying this is the if I can accomplish one thing with this miniseries, I want Impulse back in two different ways. I want a new Impulse, and I think the new Impulse should be a little girl, because I just think that would be cute as the Dickens.
And it was.
And you know, completely inspired, by the way, by Katie Power from Power Pack, another book that I really love.
Oh, that's cool.
I had to de-age her a little bit to do that, because she, this is my own thing. You may disagree. I wouldn't want to read about those kids at the age they were in the flash book before we got it.
I agree.
They were 11 or 12 or something. The kids are awful at that age. I don't care. They're just annoying. If we can make them cute, younger, you know, hopefully we feel more protective of them and are more impressed with them when they're being brave. So I thought, you know, Iris would become Impulse. And you know, we had to change her name. We had to start calling her Irie. Because obviously Iris Allen is back.
Yes.
The problem with the Flash legacy is they have, you know, they keep using the same name over and over again. You know, you have to kind of guard against that.
Well, and
you know, the other thing was I wanted to DH Bart, okay, because Bart had gotten too old in the Flash series, and I wanted to give him long hair again and slightly outsized feet. And then just say, I don't care, because, you know, people could say, well, your style ordinarily is very realistic, and yet there's this almost kind of anachronism with Bart Allen sort of having that little Umberto Ramos distributed face.
Absolutely.
Okay? I don't care. I'm going to do it anyway, because I just like looking at that Bart Allen more than I do the Bart Allen when he joined the Titans and everything. He lost what he was. He lost that innocence and that. You know, the charm that he used to have. So hopefully that's all reinstated now. And I hope the next creative team agrees with me and keeps that intact and doesn't try to... Because, you know, the thing about it is that some of these characters, to me, they had their best moments at certain times, and then they maybe evolved past those to their detriment. Guy Gardner Warrior was awful.
Yeah.
You know, but... Guy Gardner, you know, tough a-hole from the Justice League was cool.
Absolutely.
So let's put that back, you know.
No, I'm with you.
Same way with the Flashes, I think.
What happens to, is there still a development to come for Little Jay?
Yeah, that's later on down the road.
Okay.
Jeff has a plan for him.
Okay. That's good to hear, because I got to be honest, I really feel like the kids have been an anchor around Wally since... they were aged when he came out of the Speed Force, and I didn't mind them when they were babies, and I'm like, I hope they stay babies, because I agree with you. I thought as tweeners, they were annoying kids. Mm-hmm. And I do think that certainly Irie has definitely, you know, gotten a bit better character in this miniseries. So,
I hope so, yeah. I think, you know, after all, it is fiction, so why can't we have it the way we want it?
Sure. Hey, they do it on soap operas all the time, man. They send a kid to camp when she's 10, and they come back, you know, full-grown teenagers. Come on, or they, you know, they become Chuck Cunninghams, and they completely don't exist anymore. You know, so.
Soap opera guy, huh?
Oh yeah, absolutely, man. All my children.
Oh my God.
I'm not proud of it, but it's true. Come on. Another good way to get women.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking before we started recording, and Ethan asked me if I was into Transformers, and I'm like, no, I'm 10 years older than you, man. I was looking to get late. So, same with soap operas. Yeah, just looking to get laid, man.
Yeah, I hear that. But still.
Well, I don't say I watch them lately. I don't still watch All My Children, but I'll admit to have watched it for a good number of years. From teen to...
I know some guys who do that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't get it. I've never understood soap operas.
Now, that's... And that's interesting, given that you work in episodic fiction.
Oh, I understand episodic fiction. I just don't understand... The conflict being love, you know.
Oh, sure.
That doesn't appeal to me as much as, I mean, you know, listen.
I didn't care about the conflict being loved. I just wanted to look at the hotties that were on there. Come on, man. I didn't need, you know, Kelly Ripa sitting next to Regis Philbin to tell me she's hot. I knew about that 5 years earlier.
Yeah.
Come on. Same with Buffy.
Yeah.
I remember when Buffy was Erica Kane's daughter on All My Children, for God's sake.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. She was the first Kendall. There you go, man. So Christopher Reeve came from, it wasn't Young and Restless. I forget what CBS, I want to say Guiding Light or something like that, that he was on before he became famous. And Meg Ryan came from the soaps, and Demi Moore was on General Hospital. Don't get me started, Ethan Van Sciver.
I'll try not to. My God, you've got an encyclopedic knowledge of soap operas.
It's sad but true, man. Let's move on to other thoughts. What else do we want to discuss as far as the Rebirth series? Yeah.
Well, I guess nothing because issue 6 still has to come out and people need to read it.
Right. Okay.
It's finished for me, but not for anyone else. So, that's that. But you know, I hope there's some insight there.
Yeah, I think I think as far as designs and things like that, Max of course comes back and looks great.
Love Max. Love Max Mark III. If I could, I would do the Kid Flash Max Mark III series, but
that'd be cool.
I think that's been put on hold. I don't know why. I'm so far away from removed from what's going on right now that I really don't even know why that's on hold, and I haven't bothered to ask. I know they had a writer, but not an artist. Maybe there are no artists to go around. I find that hard to believe.
Well, as you were saying earlier in the conversation, it's because they all want to be writing their own books now. Clearly.
Yes. Oh, how great would that be if that were true?
Do you have
Mass Revolt and Exodus?
Are you sitting with a bunch of ideas that, you know, given the moment, you would be happy to start pouring through? And
already doing it.
Good.
Already doing it.
I'm glad to hear. I know other artists that are doing their own thing as well, and I think this is great.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I did, here's what I promised, and this is happening, without a doubt. Cyberfrog is coming in 2010. No matter what choices I make, you know, for people listening who don't know, my contract at DC ends shortly.
Okay.
I've been with DC for 6 years now running,
wow.
My contract ends pretty soon, so... For people are saying, what are you going to do? Are you going to re-sign? Or, you know, what are your plans? And the answer is, I'm not sure yet. I'm talking to everybody. But it's kind of nice to just not know right now. It's the first time I've, been able to sort of sit back and consider a very wide array of options rather than just what's the next, DC project. So at the moment, I've written a 6-issue Cyberfrog series. I have a publisher for it, and I'm definitely doing covers. I don't know if I'm going to draw the interiors or not. I probably won't. I'm talking to somebody who fans of Cyberfrog are very, very familiar with, and he'll probably step up if he can to
okay.
do the interiors. It was so fun to just write Cyberfrog again. It was so fun. and to draw him. I drew a new Cyberfrog piece, updated his look and everything. And I created a very appealing-looking character when I was 19. I really like the way he looks. He's shaped like Bugs Bunny, with the short body type and the kind of wide, flat head and long, long, skinny legs and big feet. And I just love that. So he's an awful lot of fun to draw. And then other stuff. I got a couple other things that are sort of a couple other ideas that I've got some people working on with me.
Well, very cool.
That's not to say this is going to be, the thing that I do next. It's just a couple of projects.
Projects in the background.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and I understand, and I've been there where, you're kind of between... staying with one company or possibly going to another. So in a lot of ways, that's a great place to be, and in a lot of ways, it's a very nerve-wracking place to be.
I am nervous about it, but it is, in a way, because it's like, what if I... It gets very comfortable at DC Comics. They've always been really, really good to me. I get great projects over there. I do have fun, and...
I know there's some characters that you still would like to get to. I know one in particular... come on, Plastic Man.
Yeah, Dan said that to me again yesterday. But
come on, Ethan, let's right there. Eel O'Brien is calling.
Yeah. He said we've been saving Plastic Man for you. I don't know. I don't know if the again. It, you know, there have been so many times where it's like it's time to do Plastic Man, and then something came up that ruined it. That it's like it's almost, you know, it's like, maybe I should just let it go. Maybe I should just cut that loose and then start thinking about other things.
Would you want to take a break from drawing and you know, being tied to, you know, when it does take you 2 months to do an issue, would you want to take a break from doing books and just script?
No, I'd like to do both. And ideally, you know, because writing doesn't, you know, I don't know if writing takes me that long because I stretch it out. And, you know, I guess if I were sitting there doing nothing but writing, I have no idea how long it would take me to write a script. But I'd like to do both. And ideally, you know, not this year, but soon, I would like to write and draw my own thing completely, you know.
Right.
To write and draw my own thing. When I say my own thing, I mean my own DCU project.
I see. Okay. Well, yeah, like Tony's doing with Batman.
Yeah. Just completely take control of something, and it's you know, it's my responsibility. All, you know that they're my ideas. That would be nice. So,
is there a small idea that you'd want to, you know, I mean, it seems like with these 80-page giants and the holiday special, the Halloween special, that there's room for something.
Yeah, I wrote a story. The first thing that I wrote for DC was a Carousel story that was about 15 pages. And they were going to do a Tales from the Sinestro Corps series or something like that, like an anthology book. But Blackest Night led into Brightest Day. And I'm not sure. Again, I suppose I could ask. I just, you know, haven't bothered to ask. I don't know what their plans are for 2010. And so, you know, that story, you know, got shelved. I don't know if I would write some little thing for, you know, a little Green Lantern story now or not, but it would be easy to write Batman. Now that we're on this subject, everybody could write a Batman story because you know all you need to know about Batman.
Right.
You know, my problem is this. I don't have an extensive knowledge of the DC universe and all of its history because I have not been reading DC books all my life. I, you know, read Marvel books when I was a teenager. That's what got me hooked on comics. And didn't discover DC until I was, 20-something. And then I started working for them and you know, my knowledge of DC is sort of limited to what I learn about the projects that I'm about to draw, I hate to say. And it disappoints a lot of people because people come up and they assume that, like, I know a lot of stuff about Green Lantern because, you know, I'm so associated
with it.
No, I don't. And in a way, I think that's okay because a concept like Green Lantern, you know, is so simple. You know, the idea, if you can understand the central idea, then you don't need to have all this extra mush, you know, clouding your brain. You know, I understood right away that, like, they're called Green Lanterns, and why? What do lanterns do, you know? Lanterns light up dark corners of the universe. They shine light on darkness. And immediately, you know, all of these wonderful ideas started to come into my head, visual ideas that you know, I could use to make that concept just that much more plain and bare and naked and evident, rather than being so distracted with, you know, what happened to hard-traveling heroes and all the stuff of the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you understand who Bruce Wayne is and you understand the mythology and the, you know, the little gimmicks that make him who he is, and you know, you can tell a good Batman story and hopefully an original Batman story. I will say continuity does bear, just it really weighs down a lot of the just the joy of some of these characters sometimes, don't you think? I mean, what do you think? Continuity sometimes hinders the, you know, just how lightweight these characters should feel, like how,
yes. Well, look at, let's go across the street and go to Marvel, and I've been having this discussion. I had a lot at the end of the year, Daredevil. And I mean, I love what Frank Miller's Daredevil has come to represent. It's great. But I also admit to enjoying the happier Daredevil
and the freer kind of, you know, swashbuckler that he originally was, or I shouldn't say originally, because I suppose that very first issue was a very dark story. But, you know, you go back to the Mike Murdoch days, or even I think I'm in the minority, but Bob Gale, I thought, wrote a very entertaining Daredevil arc that came in the middle of the very beginning of Brian's run, Bendis's run. And a lot of people hate that story. I thought it was very good. It wasn't, I felt, out of character for Daredevil to have more of a courtroom problem rather than him just trying to clean up Hell's Kitchen. Hmm. And I missed that. And in fact, I guess talking to Paul Cornell, he had passed along a conversation he had with Dan Buckley and said, or no, excuse me, it was Paul Jenkins who said this, where Buckley asked Paul, he said, you know, can we ever write just one story where Daredevil has a good day? And isn't carrying the weight of his, you know, legacy and his father and everything that his Catholic upbringing represents, you know, just as a burden. So, yeah, I kind of see that. Another example, I just interviewed the Brave and Bold producers, the Batman cartoon. Hmm. And even today in the comic book stores, I was picking up my new books. There was a guy in line. He said, oh, I hate that show. You know, oh, I hate that silly Batman stuff. And it's like, you know, I'm sorry. The Bruce Wayne, or the Adam West Batman, is just as valid as the Frank Miller Batman, and people have to get used to that. And it's you can say, oh no, you know, the Dark Start and everything, and it's like, sure, but literally for a quarter of a century, Batman was the policeman's friend and operated in the daytime and fought as many goofy looking bad guys as he did gangsters.
Yeah,
deal with it.
Well, also, I mean, I think that's. It's true. Like there are many like facets and sides to these characters and different styles to them. But what I think I mean is I mean, what was, you know, what is Siege about?
Siege is Norman Osborn trying to. I mean, it's the culmination of Dark Reign.
Right.
But I mean, I'm guessing that it's, you know, Norman Osborn's hubris overtaking him, and that he thinks that a man can take on the heavens and you know, storm the heavens.
Right. What was Final Crisis about?
Let's see. What was Final Crisis about? Well, Final. You know, hey, man.
what are any of these things about? I mean, you know, I appreciate, you know, the fact that, you know, these things are extended, long, sweeping storylines that continue, and they must be very exciting to fans who have been following them very closely, but I, you know, really miss, you know, I think a project really works when it can be summed up in a few words to anyone who doesn't even read comics at all. I mean, I don't know who Norman Osborn is. If I don't understand who he is, then I'm kind of in trouble. I don't, you know, there's.
I'd say in the Siege there is a simplified answer, and that is. A man is so full of himself with ego, he thinks he can literally take on the heavens and the gods. A human being is trying to take on the gods.
Okay.
But from that, but I do agree with Final Crisis, and in terms of the convoluted necessity of knowing, like you say, the backstory and understanding that, let's go to Infinite Crisis, that, you know, the guilt that, you know, or the dissatisfaction that the Golden Age Superman has looking at how the world has changed since the sacrifices he made in Final Crisis, or in Crisis on Infinite Earths. Crisis on Infinite Earths. You know, that you're right. You have to know the original Crisis story to appreciate why there was a conflict in Infinite Crisis that needed to be resolved. This is, I think, a lot of fans' frustration with the never-ending event. When, you know, when does a story, I mean, and we're not saying that it has to be the end of the character, but just, you know, when is that conflict resolved without it opening a door to, but wait, because somewhere off in another corner, a villain laughs curiously. And I just think sometimes, you know, and I obviously, in the case of Marvel, it sounds like they finally get it and are like, okay, let's wrap shit up with the Siege. And go.
Oh, really?
Well, that's the word. I mean, that's the unofficial word. And this is something I keep hearing from the writers as well, that it came down from Quesada saying, if there's an Avengers problem, let's keep it an Avengers problem. If there's something going on with the Hulk, let's keep it in the Hulk books and kind of limit these stories. So I think that's a good sign. We'll see how it actually pans out when it comes to paper, though.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, I was angry that at the end of Secret Invasion, that it was, okay, Norman comes in, gives the kill, and now he's in charge of the end. And it's like, well, that's not the end. I don't know. I mean, you know, but then, and Brian is the first one to point out that, like, the great Fantastic Four Galactus saga, there is no last page. I mean, they literally, you know, they wrap it up by page 18, but there's a few other pages about Wyatt Wingfoot going to college with Johnny, and, you know, there, you know, Stan and Jack were already setting up the next story in that issue that things do get resolved for Galactus and the Silver Surfer. So, I don't know, man.
Well, I know. I just think that if you're going to have, you know, if you're going to have a big event, big events hopefully are going to attract new readers. I think that's the purpose of them. I could be wrong. But I just think they should be able to be boiled down. I think concepts, there's, you know, if you can say, you know, like the Sinestro Corps War, you know, guys with green rings versus guys with yellow rings. And really, that's all you need to know to pick up the first issue. Get in on it. You know what I'm saying? You should really be able to boil it down so that a child can understand it. Like, God forbid, you know. And I think that's what really goes over with fans lately. I think that is making these stories as accessible as possible. Because not all of us have been reading this thread.
The soap opera.
Yeah, this long soap opera for 15 years so that we can understand. I mean, you really have to understand, you know, the very basic, you know, who is this Superman? What the hell is going on? Why is this Superman old? Why is Lois old? I still don't, you know, these are things that can't be explained to new readers.
Yeah, simply.
You know, Norman Osborn used to be the Green Goblin, but then he died, and now he's not dead. He used to be an unsuccessful, crazy inventor, but now he's very successful, and he leads the Avengers. And it's a lot. It's an awful lot. I really like these broad ideas. I like very, very broad concepts and notions that can be built and you know, upon. But at its heart, it's very, very simple. I like your sum up of Siege. In fact, I like Siege itself. I read the first issue, as I said, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. But I think at the same time, you know, there's got to be a way to boil these things down so that they're a lot more simple and a lot more accessible to new readers. I could be wrong. These are the things that are going through my head right now.
I you know, it's that kind of conversation, Ethan, and I appreciate that, and that's why I'm glad to have you back. And when we were talking last week, I'm like, hey man, I've been wanting you to come on. And as we said, and not to reopen things that we've already discussed, but you know, I kind of knew that the delays had to be of a personal nature with Flash Rebirth, and that's the only reason why I haven't had you back on sooner, because I enjoy our conversations. I put you there with Bendis and Loeb and Fraction, where beyond our usual talk, some interesting ideas come up, and we have interesting, candid discussions, and these kinds of things are hashed out.
Well, thanks, John. I appreciate it. I like talking to you, too. Above and beyond all other podcasts, World Balloon is the best. King, the daddy of them all.
You're a good man. And I thank you for giving me a video to play with.
You know, I'm at a great disadvantage, by the way, when there's no video portion of my music, because like David Hasselhoff and his musical career, he really benefits from the video with his handsomeness, with mine.
Sure.
Taking that away, we are left with nothing but our voices. And I wonder sometimes if that's enough.
Well, I will say for myself that the audio is plenty.
Excellent.
And then let's keep the video as much of a mystery as possible and just save it for those special convention floor interviews that we have managed to do. I got to get that one piece of us from 2008 when we were talking in, or 2007. Maybe it was an 8. It was New York.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was quick. It was for my friends at Comic Book Club Live.
And oh, that show was absolutely crazy. It must have been quick. They drag you around and make you go. It's like San Diego, where you really have barely a moment, and there are people talking to you from all sides at all times, so you're trying to make everybody happy.
Oh, yeah. But it's good exercise for me. I mean, it keeps me running and everything, which
yes.
I like. I enjoy it.
Come to my gym.
There you go.
Yeah, come live in Charlotte, North Carolina. We'll both go to our gym, my gym.
Well, tonight. when you come in April, we'll have a nice walking tour of Chicago. I'll take you from McCormick Place, and I told you we'll go to Miller's Pub,
yeah,
which is that classic joint that goes back to the 40s, and you can see all the cool celebrity photos on the wall and stuff.
Oh,
and
no way.
Oh, totally, man. Yeah, you know, when you were showing me your Club 21 kind of
club.
Or yeah, the Strut Club memorabilia that you have and stuff like that. I'm like, you got to see Miller's Pub. Now it wasn't a supper club the way the Strut Club was, but it was totally a bar and a kind of restaurant hangout. But it was a huge celebrity and sports hangout for Chicago.
Did you see my Strut Club menu?
Yes.
That's been autographed by Dorothy Kilgallen and Johnny Ray together. See, things like that, like if I were having an affair on my spouse, I would not leave behind evidence like that. But thankfully, they did, and it's in my possession.
Oh, that's what it's from. I had no idea they were having an affair.
Oh, my God, yeah, the biggest, read up on it. Dorothy Kilgallen and Johnny Ray, tragic. He took her out and partied her to death. That's how she died.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. See, now, my favorite, like, celebrity of that era affair was June Allison and Dean Martin.
I had no idea. June Allison would not. I
swear to God, and of all, it was either, it wasn't Hedda Hopper, or, yeah, it was Hedda Hopper. Who was her rival, as far as gossip columns back then?
Oh, Kilgallen?
No, Hedda Hopper's rival.
Walter Winchell?
No, it'd be another woman, and I can't remember her name now.
Oh, me neither.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, anyway, it was either Hedda Hopper or her rival who went up to them and said, look, you've been way too public with this nonsense. You better stop, or I'm going to start writing columns about this shit.
Oh.
And they broke up.
June Allison seems like such a nice girl, you know?
Girl next door, absolutely. And every Jimmy Stewart movie. Honey, I lost my leg, but I still got a pitch. Monty Stratton, come on, man. Monty Stratton, Carbine Williams, which is my favorite. My favorite bio picture. Let's write a movie about a guy who invents a rifle. Okay. Outstanding, man. And then, of course, the Glenn Miller story. She's Glenn Miller's wife and Strategic Air Command. Honey, I got to go up there and kill some of the Reds. Ike is depending on me.
They would make biopics about anybody back then. They
absolutely.
Really
oh, yeah.
I mean, my God, you know, I mean, I understand band leaders were important back then.
Sure.
As rock stars.
Well, yeah, exactly. They're public figures, yeah.
But dear God, you know, a biopic of some of these band leaders and stuff, it couldn't be more drab. It couldn't be less interesting.
CB, I got a great idea. We're going to do a movie about the guy who invented the cure for syphilis.
Well, did you see?
Dr. Ehrlich's Magic Bullet.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
Have you seen Cary Grant's Night and Day? I think it's like, is that the Cole Porter story?
Yeah, and it's like the manliest Cole Porter depiction you'll ever see. Because Cole Porter was, you know, I mean, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but Cole Porter was not a manly man.
No, and I really don't think, I have to guess that if you're Cole Porter, your life is not that interesting. That movie literally is like music videos, like put together.
Oh, yeah.
And string, you know, it's like. It's barely a story at all. I mean, if you did the story of my life as a biopic, you'd have to do something similar. Like, it would have to be the Beatrix Potter story that came out, where most of it was like my drawing, her drawings coming to life and dancing around. That's what it would have to be for me. You'd have to be very creative, because for the most part, I sit in my office. I don't have much of a life. I'll be frank.
I think Aldo Ray would be great in the Ethan Van Sciver story.
Oh, I agree.
The early Aldo Ray, not the Aldo Ray that was in the Naked City episodes that I saw recently.
Wow, good for you. Thank you. Very kind.
you're Pat and Mike Aldo Ray.
So many people mostly want to cast me as, I think Lanil Francis Yu just said that I look like Joe Pesci. Which I've never heard before. Do you think I look like Joe Pesci?
No, not at all. You're tall.
Me neither.
You're tall. You're not. You're not Italian. You're not. You're blonde?
I think he's. I don't think I've ever met him in person, but I guess he's seen pictures of me, and he says Joe Pesci. And then Randy Quaid is the other one that I get, and that one I'm more sympathetic with.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I can actually see Randy Quaid, but, you know. Yeah.
I'm not quite a younger Randy Quaid.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Come on, man. Don't worry.
He's like 70. I don't.
Yeah, and you're not walking out on, like, hotel bills or whatever it was that he was in trouble
yet.
With.
Don't give me any ideas.
All right, let's hope not.
Well, it was great talking to you, sir.
As always, my friend, thank you for joining us, and when your future is set in stone, I hope you'll come back and tell us your future plans.
Oh, I'll have to. I'll have to.
There you go. Some thoughts, songs, and conversation with Ethan Van Sciver. Some interesting ideas. If you have any thoughts on some of the things that Ethan talked about, feel free to hit the talkback at wordballoon.com, and we should discuss those and air those out. And also feel free to give me feedback as well on the Word Balloon message board. The link is right there at wordballoon.com. Today's episode was brought to you by C2E2. Remember, for the first time in over two decades, a National Comics and Entertainment Convention is coming to downtown Chicago. Make your plans now to attend C2E2, the Chicago Comic and Entertainment Expo, this April 16th through the 18th. Join thousands of comic book fans, creators, and celebrities for a weekend of fun and excitement. Special guests for this year's show include Alex Ross, Jeff Smith, Jeff Johns, Mike Mignola, and the aforementioned Ethan Van Sciver. Hundreds more of your favorite creators as well. Tickets are only $25 for a one-day pass and $50 for the entire weekend. For a full list of guests, make sure you visit their website. But wait, there's more, because if you go to c2e2.com/wordballoon, you can enter your name and email, and you'll have a chance to win tickets and exclusive C2E2 merchandise before the big weekend. This is what we're giving away. One amazing VIP package, 3 weekend passes, 5 exclusive C2E2 posters signed by creator and guest of honor Alex Ross, and 15 limited edition C2E2 t-shirts. Entering the contest is easy. Again, visit c2e2.com/wordballoon. Enter your name and email. That's all it takes. The drawing for the winners will be on March 19th. Stay tuned for more exciting news about C2E2, the after-party plans, and more ways to win tickets and exclusive merchandise by following C2E2 on Twitter. John Sutter saying thanks for listening to this edition of Word Balloon. And make sure, if you have any questions or comments about the show, again, you can either email me, john@wordballoon.com, or you can follow me on Twitter, John Word Balloon. Until next time, thanks a lot for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010.